Impairment is a central concept in Anglophone disability studies, referring to physical difference, limitation, or injury. Disability, by contrast, is understood to be social, the result of such factors as stigma or architectural and design exclusions. Let me see if my slides are, yes, title. Impairment superseded the synonymous term defect in the United States around 1920 against the backdrop of workers' compensation, rehabilitation, statistics, and scientific management. Impairment was identified with function and always tethered to its counterpart, repair. In the same years, perhaps surprisingly, the discourse of impairment became entrenched in telegraph, telephone, and radio engineering, and later telecommunications more broadly. A virtually non-existent word in 1800, impairment began to appear sporadically as a descriptor of signal quality by the end of the century. Transmission impairments were formalized by AT&T, American Telephone and Telegraph, around 1920, appearing as a chapter title or index heading in the first handbooks of communication engineering, a then emergent field. By the 1930s, communication engineers had identified distortion, attenuation, and interference, including noise, as the principal transmission impairments, which in turn seemed to handicap talkers and listeners. Interference, the subject of this panel, was an especially capacious concept, a word that colloquially means a collision, something hindering or getting in the way of something else. In physics, interference refers to waves of light, sound, or heat. And here I quote the Oxford English Dictionary, exercising reciprocal action so as to increase, diminish, or nullify the natural effect of each. Interference here can be constructive or destructive. Electromagnetic interference, purely destructive, emerged hand in hand with electrical communications in the 19th century, redoubling as the electroscape became more crowded. Interference was a repercussion of the ideal of canalized communication, the conviction that speech and other messages should be channeled in a controlled way, the earth and the atmosphere carved into regulated circuits. Interferences with wired or wireless transmission could come from natural sources, bad weather, particles of dust, insects, or they could be human-made, caused by any element of the electromagnetic smog blanketing urban areas, from the hum of power lines to car ignitions to electrical appliance noise. At a 1975 conference on aerospace research held by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Paris, participants still struggled to pin down the concept. The IEEE had defined interference in 1972 as both cause and effect. Any extraneous power that interferes with the reception of desired signals or the disturbance of the signals that results. The International Electrotechnical Commission defined interference in 1973 simply as an impairment of the reception of a wanted electromagnetic signal caused by an unwanted one. The category of transmission impairment remains embedded in communication engineering today, as the discipline has become global and branched into video, data, and mobile applications. This image is taken from a 2016 textbook on digital communications, and it shows the cumulative effects running from top to bottom of interference and other impairments, attenuation, distortion, upon a non-specific signal, whether sent by wire or wireless. Although English has become the lingua franca of engineering in recent years, the concept of transmission impairment also appears in other languages. The German term, for instance, is Übertragungsstörung, with Störung referring to disorder or dysfunction. In this talk, I'll describe the roots of this discourse, how impairment came to be a feature common across different types of electronic media and transferable between bodies and signals. Although my talk revolves around the Bell system, which will also be the subject of the presentation by Marina Rosenfeld following mine, I want to set the development stage of American telephony in a broader political economic frame. Telephony itself was always an expansive category. Bell engineers imagined it to be the basis for certain universal principles of communication. With regard to radio, the broadcasting of speech, as opposed to Morse code, was made possible by the development of the telephone vacuum tube repeater, the condenser microphone, and the loudspeaker at AT&T. Moreover, radio transmission was rarely entirely wireless. Broadcasting stations, including the first American long-distance radio network, launched in the 1920s by AT&T, were linked together through wired telephone lines. Writing on electrical communication, past, present, future, in 1935, Frank Jewett, the first president of Bell Labs, subsumed the medium of radio within that of the telephone. If at the receiving station, he wrote, the interpretation of the message is conveyed to the brain through the ear in the normal function of hearing, it is telephony. All that we commonly call telephony is telephony, so also is all that we commonly call radio broadcast, whether it be news, music, or other forms of one-way electrical transmission of information or entertainment registered through the machinery of hearing. By 1967, Bell Labs researcher John Pierce, who coined the word transistor and made leading contributions to Telstar and computer music, among many other things, announced to the readers of Daedalus that the generalization of communication had decisively occurred. The future simply held more communication, faster and cheaper. He predicted that video teleconferencing, telestereo, two-way handwriting, and the transmission of synthetic speech would soon join telephony, radio, fax, and TV. This broad universal commodity, electrical communication, he wrote, is useful chiefly because it is universal, because it will connect anything with anything else. The generalization of communication seemed to manifest a revolutionary new era, alternately called the electronic, information, digital, computer, network, or telematic age, popularly attributed to specific technologies or techniques. Transistors, for instance, which undergird microcircuitry and computerization, or Claude Shannon's unifying theory of information, both exported from AT&T. Looking for a socioeconomic trend underlying these proliferating technical accounts of the late 20th century, historian James Beniger found control, defined by information processing and reciprocal feedback. The control paradigm, he argued, emerged in manufacturing and transportation in the years 1840 to 1920 as an information management response to the massive exploitation of resources and labor and distribution of goods precipitated by industrial capitalism, a response in particular to the new crises that attended large-scale production. In his book, The Control Revolution, Beniger excavates the political and economic conditions that preceded electronics and information theory, stopping short of a close examination of electrical techniques themselves. With the same impulse, but a more range-bound subject, I want to propose that impairment and its preemption are embedded in the foundations of digital media. The notion that communication should be engineered emerged in response to an eruption of problems, such as interference, in telegraph, telephone, and radio transmission, problems that came to be understood as impairments within a cultural industrial setting governed by statistical analysis, compensation, and human factors engineering. the threat of signal impairment motivated Fourier analysis for telegraphy, the early quantification of information by Ralph Hartley and Harold Nyquist, and digital coding in the form of PCM, or pulse code modulation, although I won't have time to elaborate on each of these cases in this evening's talk. The engineering ideal has often been associated with extension and perfectibility, yet it is more properly defined by capacity maximization, correction, the exploitation of human thresholds, and trade-offs between performance and cost. Telephone engineers understood communication to be always and essentially impaired, threatened by interferences that caused distortion of a message, limited by the capabilities and inclinations of human senders and receivers, unavoidably altered by the engineering process itself, capped by cost, intrinsically inefficient. Impairment is now presumed to be the default state for bodies and for machines, and an ever-present threat to signal transmission. It is, in fact, the regularity of impairment that encourages ceaseless engineering with the aim of maximizing limited capacities. So the term impairment became increasingly common across the fields of medicine, life insurance, and communications toward the end of the 19th century. Generally referenced in degrees, impairment not only emphasized functional loss, but a continuum approach to bodily traits rather than a binary one. Specifically, impairment became an explanation for reduced work capacity. Modern industrial capitalism, with its emphasis on worker productivity and the reduction of public charges, provides the background for each of these movements. The unlikely discursive conjuncture between medicine and communications in the US can more precisely be explained by substantial links between the field of public health and the Bell system, which was headed by AT&T and on the way to becoming the world's largest corporation. In 1913, for example, in the midst of the so-called compensation era in the US, following the passage of the first statewide workman's compensation law in 1902, far long after the first such law was passed in Germany, AT&T established a medical department and employee benefits. It was one of the first large companies to do so. AT&T physicians sat on the conference board of physicians in industry, established in 1914 and positioned at the forefront of debates about the medical definition of impairment, the need for widespread health screenings, and the handling of compensation. As AT&T medical director C.H. Watson explained at a 1922 meeting of the National Industrial Conference Board, the field of industrial medicine took inspiration from engineering. The plant engineer, after passing upon the integrity of newly acquired equipment, periodically carries out an inspection to determine its efficiency, its rate of depreciation, and its relationship to the other portions of the plant with which it must coordinate its functions. The same logic applies to the human plant equipment, hence the physical examination of the employee in all its phases. In 1919, the former medical director of the Bell System Eastern Group, John Billings, published an article in the American Journal of Public Health on the need for standards for recording and classifying defects and impairments. He was the son of John Shaw Billings, director of the Surgeon General's Library, the National Library of Medicine, and the Vital Statistics Branch of the Census. The senior Billings had famously encouraged Herman Hollerith to develop a punch card system to analyze census data, now a landmark in the history of automated computing. The article by the younger Billings was recognized by contemporaries for offering an early and overt distinction between impairment and defect, and for attempting to standardize and grade the various types of each. So simultaneously, the category of transmission impairment was defined within the first communications engineering textbooks published by AT&T to explain such phenomena as interference. The phrase transmission impairment had appeared in publications on telegraphy in the 19th century, but it was not used with any frequency before 1870, and examples were not classified nor systematically investigated until the 1920s and 1930s. Transmission impairments later migrated into television and video from speech transmission and later still into digital media. This image is a comparison between unimpaired and impaired television signals from the 1959 edition of Transmission Systems for Communications, published by Bell Laboratories. So I'll give you a very tiny glossary, a miniature glossary of just two varieties of telephone and radio interference, which were categorized as transmission impairments and spanned the human and machine elements of a given telecommunications system. First, crosstalk. In everyday English, crosstalk means argument or backtalk. But in the context of telephony, it refers to a conversation in one circuit leaking into another, someone else's voice sneaking into your phone call, whether wired or wireless. It was identified as a problem of telephony in the US as early as 1879, when Manhattan to Brooklyn service was first established. During the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge, four cables were new at the time, each containing multiple wires, were placed inside a temporary handrail that spanned the bridge. Conversations jumped between the wires, and engineers responded by trying to insulate each circuit with cloth, gutta percha, and other materials. A few years later, observing a similar sort of interference between adjacent telephone and telegraph wires, William Henry Preece, the chief engineer of the British Post Office, argued that disturbances and influences between neighboring wires, and this is a quote from him, Morse signals, crosstalk, strange noises, impaired the efficiency of the telephone working. Other people's speech, agreeable or not, became a crisis in the telephone system. As telephony evolved in the early 20th century, individual communications were increasingly privately channeled, and this shaped what counted as a transmission impairment. Talk was turned into a series of one-way messages transmitted along voice ways from a sender to an intended receiver. John Durham Peters has famously critiqued this version of human communication in his book, Speaking into the Air. He contends that modern technologies like the telephone and radio redefined communication as transmission at a distance, and shortly thereafter as information exchange. Even dialogue began to seem impairing to telephone transmission. Quote, on occasions of simultaneous talking in which one speaker breaks the other, as AT&T employee Lloyd Espensheed commented in 1943. In the 1920s, after the invention of the electrical filter and vacuum tube, telephone carrier systems began to convey multiple signals down a single line, using a separate frequency channel for each message, based on the co-emerging model of radio transmission. This so-called multiplexing helped make telephony affordable and available to an immense number of users. At the same time, multiplexing was fraught with bleed-through between the channels. Communication engineering thus generated its own impairments. In other words, alongside any efficient transmission technique, always came new flaws. The International Telegraph and Radio Conferences of Madrid in 1932 similarly aimed to prevent the problem of crosstalk across the radio spectrum through careful, if inequitable, allocation of the frequency spectrum to different nations and services. Espensheed, who was the representative of the Bell system attending the conference, analogized radio interference to that of multiplex telephony. Radio may be likened to a huge carrier current multiplex system, he wrote, with the common line medium shared throughout the world by radio services of various types and nationalities. The multiplicity of channels which go to make up this multiplex system requires coordination if general interference is to be avoided, and here the carving up of the spectrum into these, or the canalizing of the spectrum, carving it into channels. Crosstalk later became a feature of television transmission, where it's also described as signal bleed. When cable television companies tried to canalize TV transmission, selling individual channels or sets of channels, home viewers could sometimes pirate unpurchased channels through the bleeding of the signal. For many Americans of my generation, this is how we gained access to pornography as children. My second and final example of impairing interference is the broad category of noise. In early communications engineering, noise and interference were conflated, although later in the 20th century, noise was more specifically understood to be a cause, with signal interference being the effect. At the outset of telephony, when the frequency range of transmission was estimated to be no more than 1,000 hertz, calls were defined by noise, annoying callers and masking intended conversations, as is evident in Herbert Casson's account of telephone listening circa 1880. Noise, such a jangle of meaningless noises, had never been heard by human ears. There were spluttering and bubbling, jerking and rasping, whistling and screaming. There were the rustling of leaves, the croaking of frogs, the hissing of steam, and the flapping of birds' wings. There were clicks from telephone wires, scraps of talk from other telephones, and curious little squeals that were unlike any known sound. Early telephones picked up and amplified sounds from the earth, the weather, and the network itself. They generated interference with surrounding telegraph and power wires and other electroacoustic equipment, for instance, the short-lived Telharmonium music transmission system in New York City. Many people got free electrical music on their, whether they wanted it or not, for several years in the early 20th century on their telephone calls. In the early days of wireless, noise was likewise the taken-for-granted milieu of communication, a source of fascination and not just irritation for those listening in. In a rare firsthand account or firsthand document of the wireless soundscape between 1906 and 1909, Francis Arthur Hart of Brooklyn kept meticulous records of what he heard on the air. This logbook of an amateur wireless telegraph operator is now held in the Smithsonian Archives. I was delighted when I found it. I only know of, I think, one other article that cites it. Those of you who are historians of sound know how difficult it is to find records of people's listening and perception of sound in this time period. Eavesdropping via his wireless set on ship-to-shore telegraph communications, as well as early radio telephony experiments, including the ones by DeForest and Fessenden, Hart logged fragments of music, speech, and Morse signals accompanied by hums, squeaks, high-pitched whistling, what he called velvet sounds, static, and interference. Here he's using the word interference, and this is in the bottom quote, or crosstalk, from amateurs, what he called kids, other DXers, raising an awful noise, all trying to talk at once. As the spectrum became regulated and as communication engineers increasingly controlled the sounds produced within apparatus and between electrical systems, desired signals began to be more cleanly isolated from so-called background noise. Background noise, I think, is a concept that deserves more attention than I can give it here, and from each other. Radio noise was subdivided into classes, such as static from lightning and other atmospheric phenomena, interference from electrical equipment, and random thermal noise produced by vacuum tubes and other electronics components. By the end of the 20th century, Bell Labs researcher A. Michael Knoll noted a radical proliferation of the category of noise. All unwanted signals, he argued, across analog and digital media systems can be grouped under the general category of noise. Arguably, noise had swallowed interference at this point. They had reversed. Amplifiers generate noise in the form of hiss. Because the frequency spectrum of this noise is uniform, with all frequencies equally present, like the spectrum of white light, such noise is called white noise by analogy. Motors turning on and off, electromagnetic disturbances produced by lightning, and other such sources can generate clicks and pops. These clicks and pops are called impulse noise, since the noise looks like a sharp, sharp spikes or impulses. Sorry, I need to use my glasses for this. Loose connections can produce a sputtering noise. The carbon microphone is a source of granular noise. The quantization used with digital conversion of the speech signal results in a small error upon reconstruction of the analog signal, and this error appears in the form of quantization noise. Knoll further ascribes the origins of digital transmission, namely the technique of pulse code modulation, to the management of noise and other impairments. Specifically, he calls them impairments. Although examples of PCM date to the first two decades of the 20th century, the technique was successfully developed by Alec Reeves, working for the French telephone system in 1937, as a means of transmitting signals with minimal distortion under noisy conditions, via the sampling of these signals and the transmission instead of pulses corresponding to their amplitudes. Knoll explains, analog multiplexing suffered from noise, distortion, and other impairments, and it was costly to maintain. Digital multiplexing proved superior in all respects. So the interference caused by noise, crosstalk, and a host of other transmission impairments that I don't have time to catalog, echo, singing, overload, monkey chatter, functioned somewhat like reverse salience, and thus the focuses of engineering effort. To quote historian Thomas Hughes, a reverse salient is an area where the growth of technology is seen as lagging, a set of critical problems that, when solved, will correct the situation. Yet distinct from Hughes' well-known theory of the reverse salient as the driver of innovation in large-scale technological systems, transmission impairments are understood to be omnipresent in telecommunications. They range from malfunctions and serious distortion to transient glitches. By the 1920s, communication engineers had begun to see impairment as endemic to every stage, for instance, of a telephone call, with entropy and random noise in particular at the core of all physical systems. The impairment of noise remains, as a 2004 textbook on principles of digital communication systems states, and this is a quote, the source of bread and butter for telecom engineers. If there were no noise, there would be no need for telecom engineers. Whether noise is reduced or harnessed to productive ends, the engineering paradigm is one of management rather than eradication. So to conclude, what is at stake in identifying this discourse of impairment, which inflects the understanding of electromagnetic interference and impels the field of communication engineering? For one thing, impairment and its management require what has come to be called human factors engineering, with consequences for all of us who are media operators. Writing in 1998, Knoll commented on the need for physiological solutions to the ubiquitous physical impairments in media systems. Transmission systems cannot be perfect in the sense of eliminating all forms of impairment, he wrote. That would be far too costly. Instead, the design goal is to reduce their subjective effect on users to an acceptable level. Hence, the human factors of transmission impairments are an important consideration in the performance specifications for transmission systems. So in other words, a certain amount of impairment is required in the name of economy. Otherwise, the threats of interference, distortion, and attenuation demand constant management. I don't have time to discuss the history of industrial human factors labs. Suffice to say that AT&T is widely considered to be one of the origins. Human factors entails a statistical understanding of human traits, the design of hardware for certain populations, and in the case of electronic media, a cost-benefit analysis that disproportionately excludes certain ranges of human users or allots signal impairment to them. Just as one example, at various moments in the 20th century, the voices of atypical speakers have been diminished or disordered by American telephone technology. Speakers of Slavic or tonal languages, those with high-pitched or quiet speech. Moreover, the notion that impairment is inherent to the constitution and performance of electronic media has undoubtedly inflected lived practices of communication. John Durham Peters suggests that telecommunications are at once bridge and chasm, making what he calls an impediment of distance. The ideal of successful transmission, he writes in Speaking Into the Air, seems to have scaled from telegraphy, telephony, and radio across all human relations, installing obstacles of time and space, making time and space seem like obstacles between individuals. At the same time, I'm arguing successful transmission has always been compromised, seemingly dependent upon engineering. Efforts to control communication and eliminate impairment have caused the latter to manifest everywhere. Transmission impairments have been discovered at smaller and smaller scales, ceaselessly driving more engineering. Seeming to minimize impairment, communication engineering has exacerbated it.